This time it's guns for Christmas.
This is Hunting Humbug 101, a crash course in shooting down bad arguments.
Welcome to Hunting Humbug 101 with me, Theo Clark. There hasn't been a podcast for many months now, and there's been a particular reason for that, which I'm going to share with you now. My father, Jeff, has been gravely ill with cancer for the last 6 months or so. He had cancer bowel cancer back in 2008. It was when he was first diagnosed, and he had an operation and been on chemotherapy and went into remission and so on. There was no signs of it. But it came back. So he'd been on chemotherapy, and basically after the last lot of treatment of chemotherapy, it really didn't have any effect on the cancer. So unfortunately, my dad, as I'm recording this, is gravely ill in hospital, and, you know, prognosis is not good. So that's what this podcast is. It's a tribute to my dad, Jeff Clark. He fought pretty hard during it. You know, the chemotherapy was pretty horrendous. And now that, you know, he's in hospital and palliative care, needless to say, it's also pretty horrendous at the moment. But nevertheless, I thought one thing I could do would be to give a bit of a tribute to my dad, Jeff, as no doubt most of you who listened to this podcast have recognised, we shared a pretty special and amazing relationship that would be amazing for anyone to have, but for a father and son is pretty amazing too. And so that's what I thought this podcast could be, is a bit of a tribute to Dad, and also then I've gone through the old archived episodes and I've picked out some of the most amusing bits to put in there, so kind of a best of Jeff as well. And I will intend to keep my scepticism and my looking at fallacies, my humbug hunting going in some shape or form in the future. What that is in particular, I'm not too sure about. But so what I thought I'd do is start with a bit of the background, just with who Dad was as a person and how he treated me as a person too, right from the youngest age I can remember. All I remember is being treated as a person. And obviously, I was a little kid or a teenager or whatnot. So we had our typical interactions, but he always treated me with respect, and respect as a person who deserved to understand what was going on and wasn't treated like a child. You know, for my particular age, he would explain things as age appropriate, but would still never treat me as a child. He'd always treat me as a person that deserved respect. And I think that's definitely shaped my outlook on how I raise my children as well, but also on how I treat other people, generally speaking, and, you know, students as a teacher and all that kind of thing as well. All right from the early stage, I just remember talking with my dad about, you know, life, the universe and everything, you know, talking about the aspects of science, and then obviously philosophy as well was one thing, a frequent topic of our conversation. In particular, not necessarily, you know, specific philosophers or whatnot, but moreover, our entire relationship really was one based, a philosophical one, but also one based on humour, as no doubt, again, you've noticed in the podcast. Giving each other crap, especially. But two of the earliest kind of bits of philosophy that I think influenced me and play a big influence in my dad's life as well was A, to do with, all of them to do with Plato, but Socrates in particular, and then Plato as well. And I just thought I'd touch upon those a little bit. One of the first things certainly I noticed about my dad is his habit of questioning, not necessarily authority, but questioning people using this kind of Socratic dialogue. And Jeff has always been a bit of a gadfly to his employers wherever he's worked, with his unerring questioning of different reasons people do things. So a lot of the time, organisations make decisions and people just go along with them. They might mumble privately about it, but he would always question that authority and using the Socratic dialogue to do that. And so in Plato's writing of Socrates' Apology, he talks about Socrates talks about how he's a gadfly of the state of Athens, because Socrates was told, well, the oracle at Delphi was told, it got back to Socrates that she said that he was the wisest of them all, and he thought, well, I'm not the wisest of them all, I know nothing, so how can that be? It's a paradox. So Socrates went around approaching all the wisest people of Athens and all the statesmen and the artists and poets and musicians and whatever. And he would talk to them, and he would use his Socratic dialogue of questioning to try and get to the truth of the matter. And what he realised was that these people might have had some expertise in one field or another, but they then assumed, therefore, they had expertise in all the other fields. So an artist might think they know about politics and vice versa. So Socrates came to realise that these people actually weren't wise because they were ignorant of their own ignorance, and where Socrates knew he was ignorant, and so he thought, well, actually, I am the wisest of them all because I know that I know nothing, and hence wisdom is knowing that you don't know. And so that's Socrates' paradoxical wisdom. And so in a way, that's certainly an aspect of my father that I picked off of him, is, you know, we all have our own blind spots and whatnot, but overall we still know that we're ignorant. And in particular, when you know you're ignorant of certain things, and you know when it's best, you know, shut up. Or more importantly, you also know that you can question other people about things, and you'll generally find out that they don't know what they're talking about a lot of the time when you question them. And so that's one of Dad's great skills, and perhaps annoyances to many of the people he's worked with, or rather his superiors, has been to question their assumptions and the reasons why they do things and so on. And a lot of the time, you find when you do that people's assumptions, people's foundations for why they're doing things are unfounded. The other thing I think that hopefully has come through in our podcast and our book is that the devotion to truth. And part of the truth is, to getting to the truth, is to really care about the process of thinking and not to care too much about the answer. And again, I think that's why we coined the term or used the term being a seeker after truth. And it's really important to live, you know, a philosophical type of life, is to be a seeker after truth and not be too fussed about the answer, but be committed to the process of getting to that answer. And so Socrates, when he was doing his apology, one of the things he talked about is that maintaining the philosophical life is the most important thing, and hence the famous quote, "The unexamined life is not worth living." So, you know, in Socrates' case, he would rather die than give up philosophy, is where he was coming from that. But I think about that all the time, and I think about, you know, the number of people who are walking around with unexamined lives. They don't examine their lives. They don't examine what's going on around them in the world. They don't think about their own assumptions. They don't think about why they believe particular things. You know, to me, they're asleep. They're unconscious. And one thing I can say about my dad is his life has been far too short. He's 61. And that's, you know, by any measure, is not a particularly good innings, not a particularly long enough life, and it's really, you know, just absolute bullshit. And, you know, I'm pissed off about it. But his life has been an examined life. It's not an unexamined life. He's lived a rich and you know, questioning and thinking and intellectual and humour-filled and loving life. And so he has not had an unexamined life. So his life has definitely been worth living. The other bit of philosophy that Dad brought my attention to, you know, when I was pretty young, was Plato's analogy of the cave. And I think that follows on a bit from Socrates' wisdom, or is knowing that you don't know. And for those who don't know Plato's cave, it's in his book, The Republic, and he's talking about a group of people who've lived their entire lives chained inside a cave and facing a blank wall. And they can see these shadows on the wall and moving around all the shadows are from beings outside the cave who are walking in front of a fire, and the fire is obviously what's projecting the light inside the cave. But all these chained people can see is the shadows, and of course they ascribe different forms to these shadows and start interpreting the shadows and, you know, working out what these shadows are and so on. And so according to Plato, the shadows are basically, you know, the prisoner's reality. The world to them is made up of these shadows and so on. And what he says is that philosopher is like, you know, is a prisoner who's freed from the cave and comes to understand the shadows of the wall, and not the reality, but he can perceive the true form of reality. Now, there's a lot of different interpretations in that, in particular in Plato's Republic, but I think the way I always talked about it with Dad was that, you know, we have our perception of reality is like we are chained within this cave, and whether you're a philosopher or not, I think that there's more to the world than you actually can see. It's just our limited perception of the world, and so there is that, you know, unyielding problem that we have with, we only have our five/six senses, and I don't mean the six senses in the mystical one, I mean our understanding of position, our position in space based on our inner ear is the sixth sense, but I won't get into that. And I think that allegory or that story of Plato's is a really good way to think about our understanding of the world itself. So as far as science has gone and philosophy has gone and so on, we are still trapped, chained inside that cave in our perception of reality. And that's one of the really interesting views of the world that was come up within ancient Greece by Plato. And it still holds just as true today as it did back then, I think. And I think a pursuit of the truth will at least try and avoid those kinds of thinking that this is all there is and this reality is all there is and there's more to it than what we can possibly imagine or see at the moment. The other thing I talk a little bit about is just a little bit about Dad's life and so on and some of the things he's done. In particular, this is just going to be a little snapshot of some of the things because my memory of it too is different to what his would have been and what my mum's would be and so on and his parents. But just a couple of things I'd want to talk about. He was in the military, he went to Duntroon, officer training there and formed some great relationships with some of the blokes there, and they had a reunion a few years back, so that was brought to the fore recently. Done a lot of adventure sports and so on, took me and my brother. Did a lot of canoeing and a lot of sailing with us when we were little kiddies, including writing articles about and getting published in outdoor magazines with photos of us all going canoeing and so on, including nearly drowning me and my brother once, but won't go into that, we're still here, so... He was at whitewater kayaking up to grade 5 rapids, so he was pretty hardcore. If you know anything about kayaking, he did some pretty hardcore kayaking. He went kayaked down the Snowy River in winter, so that's in Australia, went in the snow. Did the Nimboida River by himself. Well, he was with a group of rafters, but he was the only kayaker, including doing a grade 4 plus slash 5 section of the Nimboida River. So look that up on Wikipedia if you want, aware of it. You can look it up on the web. It wasn't exactly an easy river to kayak down. Yeah, he's always into sailing. Sailed as a kid. Worked in a sailboat factory and took us sailing and so on. We've had catamarans, lots of different types of boats, even little sabots and then little trailer sails you can go overnight on and so on. As an educator, he was a teacher at first and then became an academic and a teacher educator, and he has massive influence there. The number of people I've met who are now teachers that were lectured by my dad at his university remembered him for his humour and his insight and his no-bullshit attitude, which is, a rarity amongst academics, I find, especially in education. Really appreciated that. Some students that he taught in high school are still in contact with him and just found him to be an amazing influence on them. And he worked for Australian Aid, doing a couple of projects overseas in some wasn't exactly tough circumstances, in some tropical islands. Initially in the Seychelles, which is an island in the Indian Ocean, and about 6 degrees south of the equator, which is amazingly beautiful. That was when I was in grade 11, so I was 15, 16. And one of the best years of my life, of course, because all I did was go surfing for an entire year and do correspondence for my schoolwork, which basically meant copying the answers out of the back of the book and posting them off with a few mistakes thrown in there to make it look like I tried. For a year, my education wasn't particularly good that year, but I did a lot of surfing. And also, he worked at the Polytechnic there. He was doing a teacher training course, and he helped the locals there. They did the first 2 years of their teaching degree there, and then they went to University of Western Australia, or one of the universities over there in Western Australia, to finish their degree. And the intent was that they would come back and teach in the Seychelles. Of course, once they all got their Australian degree, they all went and taught in Australia or England or something like that, where they could earn real money instead of the local salary. But anyway, he also went to Kiribati as well, which is in the Pacific Ocean too, and did a similar kind of thing there. I was a bit older then, so I didn't go along for that trip, but my brother did, and he had a great time. And so my younger sister. As hopefully anyone who's read the Skeptic articles my dad's written, he has a massive love of language and also of humour and writing with irony and writing with a whimsy as well, and so his style is quite different than other people's, less serious in some ways, but still has a serious message. There's a whole bunch of his writing in the Australian Skeptic magazine, which you can access now for free in PDF form, because the Skeptics are putting up all the older issues as PDFs online, so I'll even put links to some of those articles too in the show notes for this one, and I might even go over some of those amusing bits there, but that really captures my dad's sense of humour and his love of language, I think, really accurately. I feel so privileged and lucky in a way that we did this podcast. Basically, we started doing this podcast after he got over his first, fight with cancer, and it was never my intention in doing it that we would, that it would capture our relationship. I would have a lasting memory of him, and my kids would get to hear their granddad, when they're old enough to understand him and appreciate him and see his personality, because that's one thing that really is pretty devastating about this whole thing. Is I've gotten to know him, and I've spent 34 years nearly now, having dad in my life, but my kids really, my oldest son, he's just turned 4, so he'll have memories of his granddad, but my young daughter, she's only 7 months old now, so she won't have any memories of her granddad, and that's pretty devastating. And but because we've recorded this podcast, at least I've got 35 hours of me and dad talking to each other, and a lot of it's serious, but there's the humorous side to it as well, and it really captures, I think, a lot of his personality really accurately. And and so whether they like it or not, they're going to be listening to it. And I think a lot of the reviewers we've had on iTunes have really noted that too, which I think was that it captured our relationship really nicely, and it captured his personality pretty well. Obviously, he's more to his personality than just on the podcast, but I think that's one fantastic thing about audio podcasts, is you really feel like you get to know somebody, and I know that that's happened with all the other podcasts I listen to, is that you really feel you get to know somebody. And so I hope that all the listeners out there felt they got to know my dad, because he was a wonderful man, and I'm getting a little bit emotional now. So what I'll do is I've gone through the old editions of the podcast, and I've found some of the clips that I think capture our relationship and my dad, and I'm going to put them in there. I edit them in now, including some of our off-air sections, of course. And I've also got little bits of where he's talking about the beginning of writing the book and so on, and little things like that. It's just a random assortment of clips. I haven't really put too much thought into it, really, so don't expect a logical sequence. So here's some of the best bits of my dad from our podcast, Hunting Humbug 101.
It starts.
Yeah, I mean, it was often the case that I'd read a student essay and they'd know that somebody was writing something that was suspect, and they could say it was suspect just on an instinctive level, but they couldn't name a fallacy. I'd been brought up in my university education on common fallacies, and so I needed to give them some background in naming these fallacies, because once you can discover the particular kind of fallacy, you have a stronger argument for saying it's a fallacy rather than just a sort of gut level instinct. So that was the reason I was interested in giving my students some skills in hunting down particular fallacies.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the main things, is the actual articulation of it. But I also think then when you have understand there's those specific different categories of bad arguments people can put forward, it then kind of hones your skills, and you actually get better at spotting it as well. So it's not just that, it's a kind of a positive feedback loop. And I mean, I suppose that's the same with anything. The more you practice, the better you get at it. So it's not just a matter of just being able to articulate it better, but it's also a matter of once you've had your consciousness kind of raised to the idea that there are these things called fallacies, then you can actually start to you radar in on them, zone in on them more, and you get an idea of when you hear a pattern of speech and you think that's sounding pretty dodgy, and you can actually pick out those specific things, and you can know which is the actual evidence they're looking for, an argument or evidence they're hiding, and those kinds of things.
Yeah, the other thing about it is that, and which we shouldn't lose sight of, is it's actually fun. That if you're watching a television program and somebody's pontificating about something, and previously you might just say, oh, that's crap, no one believes that, and so on, but you can actually name the type of humbug. And I'm thinking, for example, when we started developing our ideas and listing these things, fallacies, I can remember sitting watching TV together and we both sort of identified the particular fallacy at the same time. So it's a good basis for, rather than being a passive recipient of information from, say, the media like newspapers and television and so on, you are an active critic of the information that's coming through to you, and you know when somebody's on shaky ground. And you also tend to refine your own arguments, so it helps you. Hunting humbug is hunting other people's humbug, but also you can hunt your own humbug in the sense that you can look at your own powers of persuasion and powers of analysis and that sort of thing and improve your own skills.
Well, that's one of the things I think we emphasised in the book. The whole point of the book is it's a really small book, so it wasn't a book on critical thinking or how to structure an argument or how to write an argumentative essay. It was about how to identify fallacies, but I think we might have even used the metaphor of a sculptor with a statue, and you cut away all the dodgy bits and you're left with the image of what.
Yeah, I think disassociating ego is often seen as a difficult task by people, but I think it's actually you're emotionally cool. So when we say hunting humbug, the metaphor is, if people take hunting as a kind of aggressive pursuit and so on, it is in a sense that you're.
It's also a sport, however.
It's a sport, but it's cool reason. I like to think of a debate or a discussion being conducted with cool reason rather than heated emotions, because cool reason will get you there to a closer approximation of the truth. Hot emotion will just get you to defend entrenched positions. Look, the other thing, Theo, is that you know me very well, and as I've been talking about dispassionate argument and cool reason, you know that I'm something of a hypocrite. In fact, I'm a bubbling cauldron of emotion during arguments, but I never show it to the person I'm talking to.
That's right.
I prefer to leave the discussion, you know, as a cool, rational being, and then on my way home, I just key the Juco of their car on my way out, or their tyres down.
Hang on a sec. I've got some key marks on my car.
Oh, no, that wasn't me. That was...
We never argue, we agree on everything, yeah.
That was another psychopath.
Alright, good. Oh, so, okay.
And, well, I think I've said it before, but the thing that I find to be really enjoyable is where it's getting fairly intense, and then I look puzzled at the other person's anger. And I say, didn't you get the joke in there? You know, like... I implied that I put in a really good, funny, ha-ha joke into the conversation about 5 minutes ago, and they didn't spot it. And you can actually watch... I like doing things where you can kind of imagine the synapses shorting out,
yeah.
And you can see their eyes roll up to the right as they try and think back.
Well, my version of exactly that.
And you just shake your head and go...
Yeah.
In disgust.
My version of exactly that with a false dichotomy or false dilemma is going, I just don't think you've considered it from the other side, and then just don't say anything else.
Yeah.
Because that just leaves them scratching their head.
Yeah.
And unless a lot of the time people aren't prepared to actually call you on that, because they think, oh, they'll think I'm stupid for not knowing what he's talking about straight away.
The other thing you can do with browbeating is don't give them anything to... browbeat you with. In other words, you can stare at them vacantly. I've actually tried this. I give a lecture from time to time on nonverbal communication, and when somebody's speaking to somebody else, they, in order to keep speaking, they need to give some kind of sign that they're listening, like they need to raise their eyebrows or smile or something of that sort, or get angry indeed if they're having an argument. But if you just stare into the middle distance or in the direction of the person's face, but sort of stare into the middle distance without focusing, and say nothing at all. Don't move a muscle. The browbeater really, in the end, will dry up.
Or it'll just enrage them further, which is, you know,
also
a plus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and no, I've done that before where someone's talking to you and you just deliberately have zero facial response and it just people don't know how to handle that at all. It freaks them out.
Or you apologise, you say, after a tirade of 10 or 15 minutes, you're silent and they say, what do you think? Or, you know, what's your point of view? And you say, excuse me, sorry, were you talking to me?
I zoned out there for a while. Yeah, my wife does that to me all the bloody time, so.
Well, it's probably true. It's probably not. It's probably,
yeah. Sorry, I mean, wasn't listening to that last bit.
It's a very important skill in long-term relationships.
That's right, yeah.
You have to nod.
Not at the every 5 minutes at the right point in time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like when you tell me your anecdotes for the 50th time, I just nod along.
The trouble is laugh. I forget who I've told them to, and also if my wife, that is your mother, is present, she'll often catch me out on embellishing anecdotes, and that's really one of the most irritating habits that a spouse can have.
Yeah.
because when you retell an anecdote, of course, you make it, you know, you exercise a bit of poetic license.
Well, it's not for your own sake, it's for the listener's sake.
It's for the listener's sake. It's not to present yourself as an exceptional person or very brave or very clever. It's just to make it more interesting. And
yeah,
then
make the story interesting to listen.
The missus says, but you didn't say that. You said such and such.
Yeah.
And it's such a drag. I mean, it really pulls you down.
You didn't confront him, you ran away.
Now, I don't disagree with anything you're saying there, but I still am smarting a bit with a dismissive comment you made a bit a while ago when I said I don't contribute to global warming, and I'd just like to explain myself there, if you don't mind. Because you did say, I felt you weren't sincere in agreeing with me, because you were saying, you know, that I didn't produce gases and that kind of thing, but the thing I actually do, and this is, I do this faithfully, and I think I'm well ahead of the game in this, I sequester carbon at least to the extent I produce carbon. So I will not recycle paper.
Yeah, I know. I'm
put
very
it in
proud
the garbage
of you for
bin
that.
So it goes to landfill.
I thought you buried it in the front yard.
Well, I occasionally take a ream of fresh paper from a store because I can afford it, and I bury it in the backyard. And so what I'm doing is I'm creating a demand for plantation timber to produce the paper.
Yeah.
And the paper that is not recycled is actually goes into landfill, and that paper captures
carbon. The carbon. Exactly right. Yeah, spot on.
And I've calculated exactly that I can afford to get a V8 four-wheel drive because of my carbon capture.
Well, I want to take a trip overseas, so at my office, I've been getting all the reams of paper that are coming in, and I've just been burying them out the back before anyone uses them.
Well, look, we're so far ahead of the game.
I know.
Look, probably if people found out about that, you'd get in trouble, I'm sure, because people
that
are
understand.
Not yet to that point. They don't understand. But when I see a fresh ream of paper, I have this tremendous urge to bury it.
To bury it, yeah.
To capture all the carbon in that paper.
Because the thing is, I wouldn't have to do it if I knew that they would bury the paper after they've used it, you know. But they put these recycling bins in our office, so people are all putting their paper in that.
Yeah, and it gets used again.
It gets used again. The idiots. And eventually that carbon will get released. If you bury it, there's no chance of it being released.
They have to grow trees.
That's
if you
right.
bury it, they have to
they
grow
have to
trees.
Grow trees, yeah.
They have to sequester carbon. So it's demand-led, and it must work. It's not a matter of policy. If everyone simply buries a ream of fresh paper every week, once a week, it'll create enormous demand for plantation timber. So, you know, when you walk past a person in the street, I just look at their faces, and they're usually dull. they're looking at the ground. Their shoulders are hunched. Some of them, their knuckles are dragging along the ground. And I say, "Yep, smarter. Yep, smarter. Yep, smarter." You know, as I go past,
I do the maths.
I've never met someone face to face who was actually smarter than me. I don't know where these stats come from. You know, I don't think I do particularly well on an IQ test. But there you are.
if, to get back to that, you know, a bit off topic from the actual point, but the you don't...
Was that an implied criticism of your father? Just watch it, young man. Theo, shall we give out one of our easiest, most simple ones so that it becomes commonplace? I think we should, because that would force me to think further. But the one that, to me, is the easiest to do and stops the other person in their tracks, whether they're employing simple-minded certitude or not, is you just say, it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that at all. And if you just say that, they start to try and think about what you mean by that statement. It sounds devastating, but in fact there's nothing behind it at all. But I, now that I've disclosed it, I fear it may become fairly commonplace.
Well, I actually think you disclosed that one already in a previous Schadenfreude in a previous podcast, actually.
That doesn't hear me. It doesn't surprise me at all to hear you say that. It
doesn't surprise me at all either.
It's just the sort of thing you'd say if I hadn't disclosed it previously, just to undermine me and just make me feel more and more awkward. And I know you'll edit this, so it makes you appear...
You're still there? You're gone.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast, and you will hear from us again in a couple of days, and then in a fortnight after that. So it's goodbye from me, Theo,
and it's good night from me, Ramon. That'll be explained to you next podcast.
We're going to forget to explain that to the next podcast. I think you should just explain it to him now. I think we've talked about it a bit before about our ordering coffee.
I think you may be right, and I think my Ramon has sort of become a bit of a legend locally, so people don't believe me anyway. I think I actually have explained it before that I give a false name when I go to a coffee lounge and they ask you your first name. I regard that as an impertinence. I'm an Australian. I'm proud of my Australian culture, which regards first names as an impertinence. Any interpersonal distance less than 200 or 300 metres is an infringement of my human rights. And if anybody looks as though they might be going to be aggressive towards me, I punch them first, just in case. That's part of my Australian culture. I'm proud of it, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it was you that introduced me to that ancient martial art of lap dock, where you walk around with a bit of wood, and then you just hit everyone first, just in case they're going to get you.
So, the thing is that I have a reflex action to any celebrity who pontificates about anything other than their own industry, and that reflex action is to turn the television off, for example, if they're on television, or if I'm in somebody else's home, or I've just broken into somebody else's house and turned their television on, I'll throw something at the screen. And I have actually shot a television on one occasion with a .22 rifle, but I don't want anyone to know about that, so please don't spread it.
So, and the other thing, just to remember about this podcast, what we're saying about begging the question is absolutely correct and true, because what we're saying about begging the question is correct and true.
Well, probably not correct and true, it's more as right and accurate.
That's true.
Yeah. And we know that because what I'd said previously on other stuff was also right and accurate.
When you look back through what we said, you can't find fault in it.
No. And therefore you should have faith in what we said.
I think we said enough.
Yeah.
If we go on even more, people will become convinced that there's some subterfuge involved and we're not really on top of this.
No. And
in the question.
And our listeners know how accurate we always are. We have been in the past because we've never had subterfuge or just, you know, spoken a lot of crap. Not once.
Well, we have, but it's never been detected.
No, that's true, as far as we know.
I can't even be sure when you're speaking horseshit.
Well, I think I'll just leave it there.
I myself, and this will surprise many of you, I come across as a person who immediately knows
when somebody is engaging in bullshit.
That actually surprised me that you think you come across that way.
Well, I've hidden that talent from you as my son.
Because you're very good actor.
I didn't want you to feel inadequate. Otherwise, you wouldn't have participated in these.
Well, it worked very well because I certainly don't feel inadequate around you.
But our listeners probably, and don't forget, our listeners are not probably as bright as we are.
That's an assumption we can make.
But it often comes across that I know immediately whether somebody's using something fallaciously or not. But in practice, I sometimes don't, and sometimes on mature reflection, it might be days after an argument, I think back to an argument, and I think back, my God, that idiot was right.
Yeah.
The important thing to remember is never to contact that person again, and never to admit that they were right. It's not good for them.
He's just recently become born again.
Well, if I can jump in there, a highlight for me, which was one of my inspired moments, and it wasn't planned beforehand, but I saw you talking earnestly to one of these booths. And I came and sidled up to you, and it was apparent that we were related or something like that. And I said in a portentous tone to you that Theo, our pastor, has told us that these people are the spawn of the devil. And then I walked away and left you to it. It was just so... The spawn of the devil is such a wonderful phrase, and I must use it more often.
Well, you used to use it on me all the time, but...
I just think, just prefiguring, we will be discussing later our response to some of the comments that we've had. Most of them, of course, are overwhelmingly positive. Now, some of our comments about some of the negative comments might sound superficially like special pleading, but in fact, we have always have very good reasons, very sound reasons for criticising a critique. I just thought I'd make that point.
And it's just that we would explain those sound reasons, but we just don't have the time to get into it. So
can I be frank too, Theo? I think a lot of people are not up to the point where they could understand the explanations, even if we tried to simplify them. But more of that later, perhaps.
Well, yeah, and because it is you need to heighten your sensibilities to be able to have that general feeling and vibe about fallacies. And if you haven't got that kind of vibe and you're not in tune with it, you're not harmonious with it, then if you're not in that same kind of plane of
I would go further than that. I'd say if you don't live it 24/7, you don't know shit. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I just got carried away.
It's perfectly understandable. All right, my battery's just literally about to die, so why don't you just press stop for a sec? How are you going? Do you want to keep going, or you want to do the rest of it?
I can.
Yeah, because I got a second battery. Yeah. I just got to turn my computer off, and put the other battery in. That's all.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I can do it.
Yeah.
Now.
Okay. All right. Well, just give me. I'll be back on Skype in about 3 minutes. So just press stop, and,
okay.
And we'll continue recording the next bit in a sec.
I press stop.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be see you, but I'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Schadenfreude. Guilty pleasures of humbug.
Well, the iTunes especially has been really good. Like, we've had a, there's like 10 reviews on the American iTunes and like 4 on Australia, and there's a Kiwi one and there's a Pommy one. So it's been really good, but, I thought the ratings on iTunes were what they rate our podcast as, but now I'm thinking maybe that's the actual accuracy of their rating. So,
I've got no idea about these technological things.
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example.
Yeah,
there's this one rating, the latest one on iTunes in in the US by Greg Clark, so good surname, and he said, glad I tuned in and gave it 5 stars, right? And I thought that was his rating of how good he thought our podcast was. But and then it makes sense, because he says, Theo and Jeff Clark's podcast may be the only one out there solely devoted to spotting fallacies in thinking. This stuff is really informative, and the presentation is peppered with some top-notch droll humour. Thanks, guys. So I thought, yeah, okay, he was rating it 5 stars, okay? But then the one we got previous to that one on March 13, by this Eric Demage guy, he says the following. He says, if you can get past the excruciatingly bad theme music, so that's not true, a mix of bad sound clips and jazz, so it's not jazz, I don't know what he's talking about, and annoying pompousness of the hosts, the podcast has wonderful explanations of how to dissect bad arguments and faulty logic. So to me, that's, and he gave us 3 stars, right? And I thought, oh, well, 3 stars is how he thinks of it. But then I thought, no, he's 3/5 of his review are correct and 2/5 are wrong. And I'll go and read the rest
of
it.
Oh, I see. Yeah, a bit about the pompous.
Yeah, well, that's the bit that's obviously wrong. And also the music's good. And then he says, the host used a variety of British, Australian, American media clips. So that's all correct. So he's got that right to make their points, often with devastating effect. That's correct as well. But then he goes, listen to this bit. He goes, but again, the value has to be filtered past the hosts, who are utterly convinced that if it doesn't fit into their neatly logical world, it absolutely, positively can't under any circumstances be true. There's no, well, gee, I believe if I saw some reputable evidence or such. There is.
Listen, you don't think he's onto us, do you?
Nah, oh well.
Because the thing is, I've been waiting for someone to catch us out on this one thing that I, you know, whenever I say something about, I express an opinion about something we've said or something we've seen on YouTube or something like that, I know in my heart that I don't know what I'm talking about, and, you know, sometimes I know in retrospect I've actually called it the wrong fallacy and that sort of thing, but the point is that you always back me up. So even though you know I'm wrong, you always say, oh yeah, that's it, Dad, you know, and you sort of add to that. And I know a lot of the things you've said have been really completely wrong, and I've just backed you up.
Yeah,
you
know, but
because the thing is, that
yeah, but I'd say the thing is, but like we can get away with it because we know our listeners know way less than we do. But I would think he caught us out, but then he doesn't actually go on and give an example. So yeah, well, actually, he does give an example. He says the lowest point in the series is an episode where they attack a celebrity's views on vaccination based on her hair color, blonde, and previous occupation, Playboy centerfold. So, you know, I mean, he got us there, I suppose.
No, he's not onto us then, because that was just a non sequitur we just threw in there.
Yeah.
So he's not onto us, but it's possible that at some time or other, like a smart person is going to
There is a chance.
Start listening to us. And I think we've got to be prepared for that. So this may be an ironic statement, or it may not be.
I like it.
And that will just increase the confusion, because the thing
brilliant.
Is,
all
if
right.
we muddy the water enough...
Yeah, I'm going to put that in. I'm going to put that in this podcast for sure. That'll be the beginning of it, definitely.
If we muddy the water sufficiently, then our pomposity...
That's right.
Which, you know, it seems like pomposity to others.
No, but look...
When you and I are talking together, we know we're not being pompous. Well, we're just being very insightful.
Well, but, know. I mean... The thing is, does the dude even know what the word pompous means? Like, is he on crack or something?
I think pompous, I think, you know, it comes from pomp and ceremony.
Yeah, exactly.
So a pompous person is like, I don't, actually, this is not something I'd like our listeners to know, but I'm comfortable when we're doing these podcasts via, you know, various technological means and so on. I actually like to take my clothes off and sit in the nude. So, I couldn't be pompous.
Yeah, it's not too bad now, but over summer I could hear the squelching on the leather seat that you're sitting on. That was nasty.
Yeah. Sometimes on hot days when I get up it hurts, you know, like ripping a bandage off, but like it's just to relax myself, and really a pompous person would dress up.
Yeah, well, I mean, given we laugh at fart jokes and hand relief, I think that can rule out us being pompous.
But I mean, it's not. I don't discriminate in terms of models and things like that, because I imagine everyone naked, wherever they are.
Well, that
whenever I see
them, from you being naked all the time. So,
in fact, I think these comments that I've seen, that you drawn my attention to, I think all of the people making those comments are probably engaged in some unpleasant activity.
Well, the typos, I mean, the explanation for that would be if they were using the computer one-handed, so...
Yeah, see, if I can just add something to that too, serious vein, I actually like to have fun whenever I'm engaged in this area of fallacies and so on. So I tend to use a lot of irony to make my point, and it may come across sometimes that I'm flippant or glib and that sort of thing, but there's a serious purpose underlying it, which is that I started being interested in this field because of really what I was reading in the newspapers and seeing on television, and I realised that journalists actually weren't doing their job and interviewers weren't doing their job, so I sort of wondered what the hell was going on, because I knew they were wrong, but I didn't know quite why they were wrong, so I revisited some of my old writings and readings from my undergraduate days and started reading in the area generally of fallacies, and I realised that what a wonderful set of tools these fallacies are. If you're watching a television show and somebody's being interviewed and you know they're getting away with murder, or the interviewer is asking really stupid questions, and you can actually identify precisely what's going on, it actually stops you from hurling a large object at the television screen, and you can kind of get more relaxed and analytical about it. But whatever I do in life, I try and have some fun, so... just be a little bit tolerant of our irony and try and pick it if you can. Some people don't have a natural aptitude for picking up irony. Others do and appreciate it and see the humour in it.
Yeah, and if you don't pick it up, you know, it's just because you don't have it and maybe you should work on it.
That's right. And it's impossible to teach irony to a person who's irony deprived. they really have to be smacked over the head with it many times before it actually sinks in.
Alert! Irony! This is a podcast on special pleading. Note the irony just in that last section. Alright, happy with that? Alright, yeah. And, I mean, the thing is, as much as I do enjoy the feedback, I mean, who the hell are these people that come on our website and actually try and point out who we're wrong about something?
I think there's all sorts of freaks and misfits. I'm not saying these people are in that category, but there are all sorts of freaks and misfits out in the society at large. I mean, every neighbour I've ever had, and I've moved to many houses, every neighbour I've ever had has been a freak and a misfit. Yeah. I mean, they've been aggressive, unpleasant, unneighbourly, provocative, argumentative, and it's not coincidence. It must mean that pretty well 90 to 95% of all Australians must be freaks and misfit. I used to have more problems from neighbours when you were living at home.
Okay, we'll leave it there then. Yeah, but look, in all seriousness, like, I'm glad people think they're learning stuff, but, you know, it takes years to get this good. And to again, going back to the sensibilities that we've developed, it's almost, how do you explain it to these people, you know? Like, I can't even see how I can do it. They need to study for years and years to even get near where we're at now.
Well, the other thing is to be able to speak some truth and some exaggerations and some outright lies seamlessly without people being aware of whether you're actually being truthful or lying. That takes a lot of experience. So I think we've got to be more sincere. And I mean that.
I don't know that you do. That's the problem now. We've gone too far.
We'll never be able to get back. No one will believe anything else. No one will ever believe anything else we say.
Ah, screw them.
Oh, my God.
So that was the best of Hunting Humbug 101, in particular the best of my dad, Jeff.
And as an epilogue, he did pass away this morning at home. So that's why I'm going to release a podcast now that has a tribute to my dad, Jeff, as I said earlier. But yeah, as far as the podcast itself goes, obviously that's why I haven't been podcasting a lot of late. But I'm sure I'll be doing something in the future because it's such a good medium. So keep Hunting Humbug in your iTunes subscription because, there'll be some update in the future. I think I'd still want to keep doing something. So I hope you enjoyed listening to the best of my dad, Jeff, and me. If anyone, this is the first time you've come across this podcast. It's probably the downer of an episode to come across in a way, but also hopefully it shows you how funny my dad and Jeff has been. And so please go back and listen to all the other episodes because there's a lot of wisdom there. And again, as I said earlier, I'm so grateful that I got to do this with Dad because we've captured his personality in digital format for, as long as this computer's around, he'll be able to be listened to as well. So anyway, one last clip of me and Dad and talking our usual rubbish, so enjoy. Help humans, it will help animals as well, other animals, because they learn from what they do and they can learn to treat other animals. Oh, you serious? Did you lose everything? At this point in the podcast, Jeff's computer crashed and luckily we were able to salvage pretty much the entire podcast up until this point, just before I was signing off anyway. We're able to do that because there are the complete utter legends out there, and I mean that. Thank you, whoever you are, mysterious stranger, that write computer programs that enable you to salvage material that was stored in temp files. So, at this point, I'm going to say bye, just in case Jeff's computer crashes again. Although, given I'm using my own, that's probably not going to worry, affect me too much.
Schadenfreude. The guilty pleasures of humbug.
Okay, so you managed to recover it, that's great. And we're off here now, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're finished. Just before we ring off, I just couldn't have done it again if we'd lost it, because just dumbing down my vocabulary every week for these listeners, like we're assuming they have a mental age of 10, and it's just... It's really difficult to get across some of these concepts.
Sometimes it is, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, like, if it wasn't for, there are some geniuses out there, like people who can write, having the program crash, but being able to recover the data, so people can write those programs are bloody geniuses. And occasionally, I think, oh, crap, geez, there must be a lot of people out there smarter than me. But then I think, well, not really. I mean, they have a particular field of knowledge, but if I was to, put, for example, my intellect and what I know, in a kind of volume, I kind of think, imagine the hangar for the Saturn V rocket from the Apollo program, and my knowledge would kind of just fit into that. Now, admittedly, that the entire knowledge of that there is to be known in the universe would be like, again, shrink mine down into a matchbox and then put that in the Saturn V rocket warehouse. And you'd be obviously the same, on the similar kind of order of magnitude as me. I don't know a lot in terms of the entire universe knowledge, but other people's knowledge would be the matchbox within my warehouse.
Yeah, the metaphor I have in mind is like I'm in a warehouse or some kind of enclosed space, and I've got these magnificent ideas coming out all the time. They just come all the time, and the people all around me are just like cockroaches, It's like talking to cockroaches. It's useful to talk to them because it helps you clarify your own ideas. But as far as the cockroaches themselves being able to make use of those ideas,
well,
it's just never going
to happen. But I mean, I find that's the thing about having to pretend to pretend that other people's ideas have any kind of merit or value in order to not appear sanctimonious is what I find really difficult. I've become quite a good actor. I mean, you are one of the greatest actors, of course, I've ever met. But, I mean, acting isn't exactly difficult as opposed to...
Oh, no, no. Well, actors just simply spruik other people's lines. And
yeah. I mean... They stand where they're told.
When you're watching a rubbish... That's right. When you're watching a rubbish show, you've got to remember that the writer of the show is rubbish, is dumb.
Yeah.
But the actor is dumb by several orders...
He's even dumber.
Several orders of magnitude dumber than the actual writer, because all the actor does...
And just look, again, I already said it to you before, but, man, you were on tonight. I mean, you were so good.
Oh, it's pearls before swine. That's the trouble, see. Like, us talking to each other is always of value. And if other people can kind of listen in, some of them will benefit. You know, some of them will benefit at some time. So something will sink through that thick, you know, the thick skulls out there. But it's just such a privilege talking to you about these sort of things, even though we have to dumb down our vocabulary, you know. But
given the number of downloads we get a week, which admittedly is pretty minimal, I would guess at least one person out there listening per episode would comprehend what we're saying and understand it. Just because, you know, we're probably in the top percentile. Which means that if there's 100, say, downloads, there's one other person of equal to us who's listening to it.
Yeah,
I'd love to hear from them, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I think you've got to discount the fact, too, that many of the downloads are like chimpanzees playing keyboard, you know.
They've just accidentally
hit a button that results in a download. But I kind of ignore that factor, and I sort of take pride from all the downloads, but I know some of them are actual chimpanzees who are accidentally hitting that.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I suppose we should go.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Next
all
week.
Right.
Yep.
Anyway. Okay. Yeah. Next week. Okay. And we'll.
Yeah. Feed the chooks. The trouble is I can hardly stop doing that sort of stuff. Like.
All right. That was gold.
Okay. Bye.
You've been listening to Hunting Humbug 101, a crash course in shooting down bad arguments. Head to the website www.skepticsfieldguide.net for episode info and download your free copy of the ebook Humbug the Skeptic's Field Guide to Spotting Fallacies in Thinking. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or another RSS feed.